This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the space in the metaverse where you, me, the top experts, and a big subject get together for 28 minutes. This week, what are we to make of what's been going on in China, where anti-lockdown protests have turned political? China is one of the few countries in the world that still has a zero COVID policy. Back in the spring, The Briefing Room discussed how that policy was causing all kinds of problems. And then, last weekend, there was an eruption of public protests across the country against the incredibly strict lockdowns. And some of these protests became overtly political. So, has the Chinese government and its all-powerful leader Xi Jinping overestimated its ability both to control the virus and to control its people? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's understand a little more about the protest that we watched on our TV screens. Joining me in the briefing room is David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief at The Economist. David Rennie, what prompted last weekend's protests?
It's a real frustration about the lockdowns and the controls of zero COVID. And I think what's really striking about these protests is that some of them were kind of very political, and you saw these extraordinarily rare and dangerous slogans about to down with the Communist Party. But I think we need to understand that that was only a very small part of it. And actually, in some ways, the real threat to the leadership here is how broad-based the frustration is. And so you're seeing worker protests about people who are worried about cases in their factory, climbing fences to escape. You're seeing middle-class homeowners saying, you know, how come this guy in a red armband thinks he has the legal right to shut my entire apartment block down for one case? You're seeing students talking in very political ways. You're seeing migrant workers kind of kicking fences down to go and earn some money. And so everything is coming together, and the link is a sense that zero COVID has been going on too long. And as case numbers soar, it doesn't seem to be working.
David, there was a specific incident, wasn't there, that seemed to kick this whole thing off, a fire in Urumqi in Xinjiang. Were the people protesting in Beijing aware of what had actually happened there?
The fire in Urumqi was absolutely one of the kind of causes for the protest. And we saw it began in the late evening by the banks of a river with people lighting candles and singing songs of kind of memorial for the dead. And the reason that this fire really became a sort of real touchstone was that the rumour, though the government denies it, is that the fire exits had been locked and that fire engines couldn't get through COVID barriers, and then people couldn't escape because the fire exits had been locked. And we've seen that happening in other places. The government in Xinjiang, which is obviously also notorious as one of the most tightly policed places in China because of the Uyghur Muslim minority, they deny this. And there was a press conference, which I think made the public still angrier, where they blamed the victims and said it was their fault for not saving themselves. And that kind of heartlessness, and the fact that for so many Chinese, the idea of being trapped inside a burning building by locked fire escapes really resonates, because a lot of people have been locked into buildings or seen fences kind of close them in. And so something about this fire really caught people's imagination. And it's also because zero COVID doesn't seem to be working. So I think, you know, it's important to understand that for a long time, the Chinese public was a lot more supportive of these very strict pandemic controls than people in Britain might have assumed. They might think that people have been furious throughout. But actually, for a long time, for the last nearly 3 years, a lot of China was pretty normal, if you didn't mind scanning health codes all the time and being tested and wearing a mask. But only a few places were locked down at any one time. What's gone wrong is that the number of places locked down has gone way, way up because the case numbers are rising. And people are now more conscious that maybe the outside world is living with this virus and looks more normal. And so it's that combination of it's getting more oppressive, and yet it doesn't seem to be as worthwhile. And so this frustration is really now bubbling over.
How do they know the rest of the world is living with it? What are they seeing, and how are they seeing it?
So if you are a kind of an old person in a village who gets all of your news from official state TV and you watch the Xinwen Lianbo, which is the main sort of evening news, then you still don't know. It's absolutely extraordinary. Every single night, one of the last items on the news is shots of some American hostel, people dying in intensive care beds, a big screenshot of more than a million dead in America, and this kind of message that the outside world is still unbelievably chaotic and dangerous. But there are plenty of ways in which Chinese people will see the outside world. For instance, the most recent Football World Cup, people have been seeing the crowds, although there was evidence that Chinese TV was censoring crowd shots for a while. That seems to have eased off a bit because they're being mocked for it. But, you know, if you're a young Chinese person, you follow Hollywood or you foreign fashion, you can't help but notice that people aren't wearing masks, that the Oscars are still going on, that Fashion Week is still going on. So there is more awareness now than there was that the outside world is kind of getting on with COVID and that maybe the latest variants are not as dangerous. And so the sense of kind of fear has really started to change. And even, you know, that was true for young people for a long time. But I was doing some interviews recently with a young artist who said his parents used to be scared of COVID and now they're scared of COVID control policies. And that's a big shift.
When we come to the protests, firstly, we know that obviously China is a huge country and therefore measuring the size of protests and the significance of protests is difficult. What can you say about how these compare with previous protests in terms of their scale and in terms of their political demands?
So I think it is very important not to look at China and say, oh, students are protesting, this must be back to 1989, the Tiananmen Square sort of protests. I think it's very important not to say, oh, so China's now joined Iran or Belarus on the list of countries where and oppressed people are rising up against a hated dictatorship. China is a much more complicated country politically. A lot of people basically support the system because they think it has served them well and they think the West is in terrible trouble, but people are very frustrated with specific aspects of it. I was at the protest in Beijing, which was incredibly unusual because you had people right in the center of the city sort of saying very political things for 5 hours and the police were being very restrained until the next day when they went around and started rounding people up. But, you know, the honest truth, it was actually probably 200, 300 people in a city of nearly 20 million. So it's not the size of the protest, I think, that matters. I think it's the diversity of the protests. You have worker protests, you have middle-class homeowners complaining about being locked in, you have migrant workers complaining about not being able to go and earn money, you have students complaining about being locked in on campuses for months on end. And the fact that the system, in order to make their pandemic controls work, has had to kind of reach deep into everyone's everyday lives. So a lot of the time in China, if you don't choose to think about the fact that you live in a very kind of iron-fisted autocracy, you can sort of tune it out. But under COVID, you can't tune it out. It's everywhere. And there are these unaccountable kind of pandemic guards and workers bossing you about, locking you in, shutting your building down, shutting your office down, shutting the schools down. You know, where I'm sitting in Beijing today, all the restaurants are closed, all the bars are closed, almost all shops are closed, the traffic is very light. And, you know, and this isn't the first time. It's been many times over the last 3 years, and it feels like we're kind of back in, you know, 2020. And so people are just kind of tired of it.
Now, how surprised were you at the anti-Xi Jinping chanting? And was that, if you like, a kind of unified response by what crowd was there? Or was it from a section? In other words, could it be easily isolated?
It definitely can be easily isolated. And I think it's sort of frustrating sitting here in Beijing covering China to see that all the focus is on the most political sort of slogans about Xi Jinping. They are very dramatic, but they've involved a very, very small number of people. And I think that if you're the party, that's not actually necessarily what worries you, because they have built this absolutely extraordinary surveillance and police machine, which is now, as I speak, rounding up lots and lots of the students and young people who are at the protests in Beijing or Shanghai or elsewhere and calling them into police stations, tracking them with their phones, with cameras, with facial recognition, scaring the living daylights out of them. If needs be, calling their parents, saying, you know, your kid's going to get kicked out of school, lose their job. You know, the machine is doing what the machine does. And so I never want to say never that protests aren't the thing that should frighten the communist leadership, but they have built a machine to take care of political protests. And so I think it'd be a mistake to focus on the things that maybe Westerners are looking for, which is down with the party, down with Xi Jinping, and to miss the dynamic, which I think is much more powerful because it's so much larger and so much broader here, which is that even Chinese people who aren't very interested in politics, who maybe choose not to be very interested in politics, they are sick and tired of these very intrusive, very bossy, autocratic COVID controls because they don't think that they're doing their job anymore and it's been going on too long and it's killing the economy. And so that, I think, because it's such a large force and not necessarily only the most political people, that matters more.
David Rennie. One critical factor behind the protests appears to have been the ability of Chinese people to access restricted information and to contact each other to coordinate protests. What does this tell us about who's winning the information war? Kerry Allen is a Chinese media analyst with the BBC. Kerry Allen, how easy is it for ordinary Chinese people to access independent information about what's happening in China or in the rest of the world?
It's extremely difficult. China has one of the most restrictive media environments in the world, and it's constantly ranked near the bottom by rights groups for media freedom. Online, you've got the Great Firewall of China, and that makes foreign websites inaccessible, and foreign radio broadcasts are subject to interference, so people can't listen that way. And within mainland China, there's just very little in the way of independent media. The media environment is saturated by government outlets. So people only really see and hear what the Chinese Communist Party wants them to see and read.
How does it come about then that the protesters seemed to know what was going on in other parts of China and seemed also to be able to contact each other?
Well, very much via social media platforms. And even though those are very tightly controlled also, so we're talking platforms like Sina Weibo, which is the local equivalent of websites like Twitter, and they've long removed content that includes sensitive words related to protests. So when these protests started, the word Shanghai was censored, the word Urumqi was censored. People find creative ways to get around this. So what they do is they reference their inability to speak out. They use creative words that the censors won't know. And they're very internet savvy. They recognize these, they start using these on a massive scale. And these attract the attention of people in other parts of the country and make people realize that their frustrations are not alone, that other people are feeling exactly the same way they are.
You're describing a kind of cat and mouse game then, are you, in which people discover a new way of getting around the restrictions and then presumably the government has people in place to try and stop it?
Very much so. So when Shanghai was censored, people were taking A4 pieces of paper out onto the street to demonstrate we are a blank sheet of paper, we can't say anything, this is literally how much we can say. And what happened was that blank sheet of paper, white paper, were then ways that people were talking on social media about the protests. When they became censored, people then started using the word A4. When A4 became censored, people started using other ways of referencing paper. So they were saying A3, A5.
What's amazing about this is the way in which people understand each other so quickly.
We've seen this previously with other forms of protest. So every year, the Tiananmen Square protests of 1989 are commemorated, and people have recognized that there are creative ways of talking about that. So even though Tiananmen, for example, is a censored search term, it's a censored word, you will get people just posting candles online because a candle is a way of commemorating someone who's died. And that has become a form of online protest. People very quickly learn that the government will try to silence them. And there are new ways that they can talk about this. And one of the ways they do it is with a piece of software known as a VPN. That's software that allows you to see websites that are blocked. And they are aware via foreigners in the country that they can use this to access Google, Facebook, even BBC News. So that's one way in which they gain an understanding of the wider world.
Are they allowed to do that?
Not technically, no. It's not illegal, but it's something that the government would rather people didn't know about and didn't see. There's often messaging about Western media, criticizing Western media, painting Western media as anti-China. And so people are told not to trust Western media. They also have been highlighting since President Trump was in power in the US that there has been this influx of fake news in the West. And so they've very much wanted to paint a message that people should trust what Chinese media is telling them and not look at media overseas. So, for example, the 2019 Hong Kong protests. It's always the case that the government will try to silence them from the off and stop people from reading about or seeing them. And then there's a narrative that's painted that it's due to foreign forces. And that's what we are starting to see with these protests, messaging about whether foreign forces led to these protests. But at a very basic level, people are saying, this is not correct. This is not why we're angry. And it's those people who are saying, we are coming out and protesting for us. We are not buying this line.
Kerry, do you get a sense that in addition to people being unhappy about the COVID restrictions, that this has also morphed into them expressing unhappiness with being restricted in what they're able to say and hear about it?
Absolutely. Back in October, just before the National Congress, when Xi Jinping was elected to a third term, there was this one-man protest where a man in Beijing took a banner over a footbridge and said, no more lockdowns, down with Xi Jinping. And there was so much media tightening at that time. There was an attempt to silence discussions about Xi Jinping coming to power, about the government doing everything right. People are very angry, not just with zero COVID, but the fact that they're being silenced. I think that's why this A4 revolution, as it's being called, is so powerful, because it's people saying, we can't say anything whatsoever. Literally, we can't say anything. We're being told what to say.
Kerry Allen. Earlier today, the Chinese Vice Premier Sun Chunlan appeared to signal an adjustment to the government's COVID policy, talking of a new situation with the danger from COVID weakening. With that in the background, I now want to look at the wider political implications of these protests. Joining me in the briefing room are Dr. Yu Jie, Senior Research Fellow on China in the Asia-Pacific Programme at Chatham House, and Professor Stephen Tsang, Director of the SOAS China Institute. Yujia, if I could begin with you. Back in April, this programme looked at the big Shanghai lockdown and its consequences. It seemed evident then that there were big problems. Why did the Chinese government not alter its policy back then?
It would be very hard to make a U-turn on such a flagship policy that indoctrinated by President Xi himself. And he wants to take this policy as somehow to show the supremacy of the Chinese governance system. So given what has happened over the last weekend, I think the main reason perhaps the Chinese leadership will have to rethink is, firstly, whether the population is well prepared for a large COVID exit wave for China, like the rest of Europe. And secondly, given the current extreme sluggish economic growth, and perhaps it would be really the right time now to begin to open the society, or at least to have the discussion about reopening to the Chinese society as a whole.
Stephen Tsang, this brings up the question about how policy is decided or changed in China, and whether this process is different under Xi Jinping as it's been historically. Because what's being hinted at now is that actually the Chinese government might now finally be open to making some alterations.
Yes, I think the Chinese government will be making some adjustments, but this is probably happening because Xi Jinping saw the protests of the last weekend, particularly some protesters asking for him to step down and for the Communist Party to step down. That really was a game changer. But then Xi Jinping will not allow himself to appear to be weak, so he has to restore order in his terms, and then he can relax. And since he has now effectively put an end to the major protest, he can make adjustments now.
So in other words, you think that he will believe that the protests have been calmed down, they haven't happened since last weekend, so now the Chinese government can be seen to alter its policy a little bit?
Well, I think the protests really caught him and the party top leadership by surprise. They really believe in their own propaganda, which was that the zero COVID policy demonstrated the superiority of the Chinese system and people in China supported. Now, they may still, in fact, be right if we are looking at the aggregate number of Chinese people who support or go against the COVID policy. But the reality is that in many of the big cities, people were so restricted, so fed up, and so damaged by the zero COVID policy that they protested. Therefore, Xi Jinping realized that he has to make some changes. He just cannot afford to appear weak.
Yujia.
Well, I broadly agree with that analysis. I mean, judging from the message given by the Chinese Vice Premier Sun Chunlin, I mean, who be dubbed as the Tsarina of the Chinese COVID policy in her statement, this is probably the first time Beijing didn't use the term zero COVID, but somehow really paved the way on the political rhetoric that the society is now entering a new phase and the pandemic control is now entering a new phase, and hence is the right time for the government taking the so-called scientific decision to reopen the society. And obviously, I think this is much largely a tribute to what has happened over the last weekend. The people have spoken. The party will have to listen.
Now, this raises a really interesting question. If you were a protester or minded to protest or knew about the protests, wouldn't you connect the dots here and say to yourself, actually, the protests worked because the Chinese government changed the policy? Stephen Tsang.
You would and you wouldn't. That, in a sense, is obviously what is happening. But if you start thinking that your protest has delivered, you have to remember that if you were on the streets protesting and you had met a police officer, the police officer would probably have asked to access your mobile phone. Do you know whether the policemen have scanned some details of your mobile phone and therefore now have access to your mobile phone and can monitor you wherever you go next? Would you take that chance? I think that is the way how the party state is using the digital technology to enhance its capacity to control and to intimidate, more effective than the old-fashioned massive deployment of soldiers and tanks.
So that's on the individual level, Yujia, but on a kind of broader social level, if you know, as a citizen looking at the combination of the events, might you not draw the lesson that the government is actually susceptible to changing its mind because of protest?
Well, I think we need to look into the root cause of protest in here. Zero COVID has been imposing so much and hindered the level and source of incomes for every single household. It's almost become unbearable. So I think that's part of the reason. I think it's perhaps the major reason why people go on street and protest against the zero COVID policy.
But in a society like China's, where if the government bends towards what the people think, it always seems to do it almost imperceptibly, this appears in a way to be perceptible, Stephen.
Well, that is exactly why Xi Jinping is trying so hard to make sure that he does not appear weak. And this may explain why he is putting himself in the background rather than in the foreground in making those changes. Because he is projecting the image that it was the implementation of the policy at the local level, which were not reflecting the policy at the very top. So mistakes were made, but not by him. So don't push your luck, Chinese citizens. If you did, wait to see what happens next.
One of the very commonly repeated paradigms about China is essentially that the Chinese people bought into an unstated compact. The government gives you prosperity and you allow them to take your freedoms. Yujia, can we just examine for a moment the generational question of whether or not the contract, however it's mutated, applied more to an older generation who'd experienced abject poverty than it does to a younger generation who may not have done?
Absolutely. I think what we have seen here is quite a generation divide. I mean, I watched some video clips, and what I realized is mostly these are people who, those who were born in the 1980s and 1990s and early 2000s on the street. Because these are the people that are most likely to be employed by private sectors in China. And the private sectors in China in the past few years had a really turbulent time and also compounded by COVID. And obviously, if there's no business, and that means there's no salary. But of course, those people nowadays have a small family to run. And if without income, of course, they feel that sense of anxiety, which in contrast, most of the elderly, I mean, for those who 50 or 60 above, the majority of them are employed by the state sector. State sector will guarantee them a pension and a salary. So is irrespective of lockdown or not, and they won't be going on the street because they have salary being guaranteed from the state. And I've never experienced that sense of generation divide as much as in this time and the comparables in the past few years.
Stephen, I'm reminded of something from history, which is that quite a long time before China abandoned its one-child policy, the leadership already knew it was a bad policy, but didn't back down. Is this a reflection of the same kind of mentality?
I think the zero COVID policy perhaps go even further than the one-child policy in reflecting the reality that there are plenty of very competent and able people in the Chinese government who understand what the problem was with the policy, but the top leadership would not change that policy. It becomes much more pronounced because Xi Jinping has effectively replaced collective leadership by himself ruling China as a strongman or dictator. So when Xi Jinping said zero COVID is the right policy that shows the superiority of the Communist Party system, other technocrats in the health sector simply could not and would not dare to tell the boss that, sir, with the greatest respect, this policy is going to cause that all kinds of problems is no longer sustainable. And the economic technocrats could also not take the risk of telling him what the economic consequences would be. So he didn't know that. And there's also a very strong element of delusion created by one man deciding on everything and not listening even to his close advisors.
Eugene, is that how you see it too?
Well, on the one hand, he's not listened to advisors. But I think on the other hand, this also, whether those advisors understand the situation itself. I mean, for me, it seems to be there are certain advisors who seems to have the courage to speak the truth. But somehow the state media didn't give those advisors airtime. So I'm afraid, I think really come back to this question of the clear messaging and whether the recipient of those information, i.e. the population, are really well prepared for reopening of the society. So I think, again, it's less about information flow, but it's about clear messaging in here.
Let's imagine for a moment that we're in the room with Xi Jinping and he says, what big lessons do you think I should draw from this, my advisors? What would you tell him, Stephen?
I would tell him, sir, the system that is being put in place at the moment is not giving the best results for China. Allowing scope for your advisors to tell you the truth in your face is what you need. That's what helped the Communist Party to avoid making major policy mistakes that could potentially bring out the kind of protests we saw last weekend for a quarter of a century. This has now changed. We need to go back to the model that worked.
Yuji, if he was being told that by an advisor, do you think he'd listen?
Well, I mean, I'll break down this very differently. I would say, sir, please do not behave like Margaret Thatcher. The lady isn't for turning. Actually, the gentleman should be, the smart politician should always know when and how to make a proper U-turn for the benefit of the country.
Yujia with Stephen Tsang. And my thanks to them and to David Rennie and Kerry Allen. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Daniel Gordon. And the editor was Simon Watts. The programme was mixed by Graham Puddyfoot. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds right now, like the one on what's behind the protest in Iran, the one on whether we can keep the lights on this winter, and the one about the staffing crisis in the NHS. It's being so jolly as keeps us going.
I find quantum.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
And I'm Robin Ince, and we have a new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. And on this series, we have been across the world, Southern Hemisphere and Northern Hemisphere. And we've been talking about what we've learned from COVID with Dame Sarah Gilbert.
We've been to Los Angeles, NASA Jet Fulton Laboratory with Conan O'Brien.
And we've been dealing with the science of aging.
Very, very dear to your heart, of course, isn't it? Because we need to explain why you look like that.
And we'll end up with our Christmas special with Tim Minchin on the science of wine. If you'd like to listen to The Infinite Monkey Cage, we're on BBC. BBC Sounds Now. You can, in fact, listen to the whole series. We'll also probably deal with the nature of stars, the death of the universe, the birth of the universe, and everything in between.
In order to make a cow, you must first create a universe. You don't make a cow, do you?
Well,
can you make a cow? Can we make a cow?
A cow from scratch.
Doing that nice again?
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.